after abroad in Switzerland, which is the epicenter of luxury hospitality. She's hoping Exalta will pay for it. The days that Kirby isn't working, she takes Jesse to the beach. As much as Kate loves seeing her daughters spending time together, she worries that Jesse will grow up too fast. "I don't want you drinking around your sister," Kate says. "Or smoking that, Mary Jane. Promise me?" "Promise," Kirby says, with a sly half-smile that means God only knows what. "We read, we sleep, we flip over every 15 minutes, we swim, we take walks and collect shells. We talk." "Talk about what?" Kate wonders. Jesse now knows Kate's secret, and Kate supposes she should be concerned about Jesse spilling the beans, but she isn't. The secret weighs only half as much now that Kate has shared it. Some days it even feels like the secret's power has dissipated, like when you turn on the light and find out there's no monster in the closet. Kate hasn't had a drink, or even craved one, for an entire week. The string of bright, hot, sunny days is broken by a rogue nor'easter. Kate has always loved rainy days on the island. Normally she would light a fire and suggest board games, but Kirby announces that she and Jesse are going bowling. Kate freezes. Bowling was Tiger's thing. Is his thing. "Do you want to come with us, Mom?" Kirby asks. Kate's first instinct is to say no, but what else really does she have to do? Exalta has been running mysterious errands lately, day and night. She claims to have made a friend who lives a few blocks away, and earlier today she set off down Fair Street with her umbrella, wearing rain boots and carrying her espadrilles in one hand so they wouldn't get wet. Kate could stay home and help Blair and Angus with the babies, but Angus has imposed a scientific method on the nursing and napping schedule that is working wonders. So why not join her two daughters? Why not bowl? The bowling alley is in the middle of the island down a dirt road called Young's Way. Kate hasn't been near the place since she used to drop Tiger off years ago, before he learned how to drive. The last time Kate actually went inside was for one of his tournaments. He won them all handily. And Kate remembers overhearing some of the Nantucket old-timers saying Tiger was good enough to go pro, which had made Kate chuckle. As if her only son would waste his life being a professional bowler. Now she would accept that fate for him in an instant. The bowling alley smells of roasted peanuts, cigarette smoke, and the damp. It's crowded today because it's raining out, but it feels cozy and convivial. Kirby marches right up to the desk and secures lane 10, which is along the far wall and not, thank goodness, in the middle of the action where people might watch them. They each put on a pair of the hideous shoes that are better suited to a gangster or clown. Kate shudders to think of the other feet that have been in these shoes, and then she flashes back on Exalta giddily walking down Fair Street in her galoshes. Most curious. They buy a large bag of warm, unshelled peanuts and three birch beers. They are ready to bowl. It's a deceptively simple game. You just knock pins over with a heavy ball. But it takes Kate a while to figure out how to plug her fingers in the holes, take the correct number of steps, and release the ball with force and accuracy. After some gutter balls, she gets the hang of it, and pins start to fall. In the first frame, Kate knocks down 6, Kirby 7, and Jesse gets a spare. Kate likes the sounds of the alley, the anticipatory rumble of the ball rolling down the glossy boards, and the crack of the ball against the pins. Music is playing in the background. Bill Haley and the Comets, Chuck Berry, and Chad and Jeremy. Kate drinks her birch beer and lets the shells of the peanuts fall to the floor. When it's her turn, she takes the ball that looks like a green and white swirled marble and holds it up in front of her face. She feels Tiger then, so keenly that she nearly believes that if she turns around, she will see him sitting between his sisters. She hears his laugh, pictures the freckle next to his eye. He's here. He's in the atmosphere. Kate swings her arm back and lets the ball go. It's a strike. That evening, Kate watches Walter Cronkite alone. Blair is upstairs with the babies, one of whom is crying. Angus has run out for a pizza. Jesse and Kirby are at the Dreamland Theater seeing Butch Cassidy, and Exalta went to bridge at the Anglers Club with Bill Crimmins. Exalta and Bill Crimmins, Kate thinks. She suddenly wonders if there's more to that than meets the eye. Bill Crimmins lives on Pine Street in the exact direction that Exalta walks on her mysterious errands. This might also explain why Bill moved out when he could have stayed rent-free at Little Fair. He wanted his own place so he and Exalta could be alone, away from scrutiny. Kate is so consumed with how incredible and yet credible her new theory is that she misses the first part of Cronkite's report. But she tunes in when she hears him mention the Cambodian border and the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Earlier today, there were 17 American casualties confirmed in an airstrike in a position near the town of Sve Rieng, Cronkite says. 17 casualties. Along the Cambodian border. The Ho Chi Minh Trail. Casualties meaning dead? Or injured? Some dead, some only injured? Tiger. Kate calls David. She can hardly breathe. The evening newspaper has already been delivered, and there was no mention of this. David says he will stay up to watch the late news. He'll call first thing in the morning. Kate tries to explain to David about that afternoon at the bowling alley. She felt Tiger's spirit. When she lifted the ball, it was as if Tiger's hand were underneath her elbow, and she bowled a strike. It had seemed like a lark, but now she knows it was a sign. That was the moment he died. He was hit in an airstrike, and his soul was instantly transported to Nantucket, to Mid-Island Bowl, where he helped his mother knock down all the pins. Tiger. Angus walks in the door with the pizza, and Kate rises to turn off the TV. She follows Angus into the kitchen like a zombie.
"Would you like a slice, Kate?"
he asks. Kate shakes her head, pours herself a vodka. When David calls in the morning, he has no further details. 17 American casualties along the Ho Chi Minh Trail, close to Sve Rieng.
"We don't know he was among them," David says. "Katie, we don't know."
But Kate does know. She felt him. It was different from other times she'd thought of him. It was immediate, visceral. "Come today," she says. It's a Friday. David is booked on the 6 o'clock ferry along with every other attorney, doctor, and businessman in Boston. "Come right now. Skip work. Please, David." If Tiger is dead, they'll send someone to Brookline. "Leave a note on the front door so they can find us."
"Okay," David whispers.
She can't tell the girls because she doesn't want them to overreact. Everyone else is enjoying August. Everyone else is happy. Jesse and Exalta return from their daily pilgrimage to the club. It was Jesse's last day of lessons. She received a certificate and a written note from her instructor, Susie, that says, "I have greatly enjoyed getting to know Jessica this summer. She has the makings of a fine tennis player and an even better person." Kate smiles and says, "What a lovely note." But her tone rings hollow. "We should celebrate her efforts," Exalta says. "How about lunch in the garden at the Chanticleer?" Kate says, "I couldn't possibly, Mother." "Why not?" Exalta says. "David is coming on the next ferry," Kate says. "Early?" Exalta says. She does not sound pleased. "I'll wait here for Dad," Jesse says. "No, no, go with your grandmother," Kate says. "And take Kirby." Kate is sitting on the edge of the bed with the picture of the family from last summer resting in her lap when David arrives. She's afraid to go down to greet him in case he has bad news. As it turns out, he meets her halfway up the stairs and says,
"Nothing."
"Nothing. No one came to the house last night. No one called." "How long does it take?" Kate wonders. "Will you come with me to church?" Kate asks. "I need to pray."
David raises his eyebrows. Church?
Please?
She says. He nods. Let this be proof, he says, that I will do anything for you, Catherine Nichols. They head outside and down Fair Street. David is Jewish, and Jewish people generally don't pray in Christian churches. Kate and David were married at the Massachusetts State House by a judge whom David knew through work. David's parents, Bud and Frida, had flown up from Florida to serve as witnesses, and afterward they took the newlyweds to dinner at Loch Ober. Exalta refused to attend, and she would not allow Penn to go, although Penn secretly arranged for a limousine to whisk Kate and David to an inn in the Berkshires for a 3-day honeymoon. It was understood by everyone that Exalta objected to the marriage because David was Jewish. In the time that Kate and David have been married, it has never mattered that he's Jewish. Kate takes the children to church on Easter and Christmas, and once a summer they attend evensong services at St. Paul's. Kate initially thinks of going to St. Paul's. It's a beautiful church with a pipe organ and real Tiffany windows. The Nichols family has belonged to St. Paul's for generations, although Kate acknowledges it's more of a social pursuit than a religious one. She could get down on the needlepoint kneelers, gaze at the light filtering in through the sumptuous windows, and pray. And David would pray with her. But at the last minute, she changes her mind and crosses the street to the Quaker Meeting House. David relaxes. He pulls open the wooden plank door, and they enter the simple house of worship. There are wooden pews on either side of an aisle that face a raised platform with bench seating. There are 4 unadorned 24-pane windows. The room conveys a holiness and a purity and a luminosity that Kate craves. She knows that the Quakers value silent introspection. Church for the Quakers is when 2 or more people pray together. It has nothing to do with bricks and mortar. Kate sits. David sits. Kate bows her head. David takes her hand. They are a church. Richard Pennington Foley. Tiger. When Kate closes her eyes, she sees his chubby infant legs and round cheeks. She hears his giggle when the girls tickle him. She sees him sulking about the lima beans on his dinner plate. Later, Kate would find them, flattened, under the tablecloth at Tiger's place. She remembers him chasing seagulls at the beach, skipping rocks, picking crabs up by their hind legs and waving them, snapping claw and all, at his sisters. She remembers rebuttoning his dress shirt correctly and wetting his hair down before dinner with Exalta at the Union Club. She recalls the way he smelled after football practice, sweat, grass, pride. She sees him leaping into the air for the ball, strong-arming his way into the end zone. He was such an excellent player that Kate had nearly been embarrassed. She sees him with McGee the night before he deployed, his chin resting on McGee's head, his eyes closed, as if he's memorizing how she felt in his arms. Kate had turned away, thinking the relationship wasn't real because it hadn't had enough time to steep. McGee would leave him for a boy who was available. But Kate would never leave Tiger. She would never replace him. She was his mother. She was forever. If he's gone, Kate thinks, she will never recover. That's all there is to it. She feels safe in the meeting house, buffered by the plain white walls. She can hear birdsong from outside, and through the window she spies the green leaves of an oak, the piercing blue of the cloudless sky. God is up there, she supposes. She hopes. Keep him safe, she says in her mind. This is foxhole religion at its most basic. The only person who wants the soldier to live more than the soldier himself is the soldier's mother. Kate wishes she were praying with a pure heart, with a decent past. She wishes she had been more devout, faithful, penitent. All she can say for herself is that she is self-aware. She understands her sins, acknowledges her flaws, owns her mistakes. So many sins. So many flaws. So many mistakes. If he's gone, it's her fault. She stands up. Let's go.
You sure?
David says. Yes, she says. Thank you. As they approach All's Fair, they see Exalta and Bill Crimmins standing on the front walk. Bill Crimmins has an envelope in his hands. A telegram, Kate thinks. Dear Mrs. Levin, it is with great sorrow that we inform you. She screams. She howls. She bends over in the middle of Fair Street, and then she's choking, retching, sobbing, and David grabs her around the waist in an attempt to pull her upright. Catherine! Exalta calls out, scolding. Kate doesn't care what she looks like. She doesn't care who sees her or what kind of scene she's making. Her son is dead. Bill Crimmins runs down the street toward them, clutching the envelope, but Kate doesn't want him anywhere near her. She waves her arms and cries, "Go away! Go away! You promised you would help him! You promised you would bring him home!"
"Katie," Bill says, "I saw the news report too, but this isn't what you think. It's just a letter from Tiger. Just read it and see what it says. It's from Tiger. Dear Ma, by the time you get this, I will be sitting on a beach in Guam for a week of R&R. Guam is a U.S. territory in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, which you might already know, although it came as news to me. Guess I should have paid closer attention in geography class. I've been awarded R&R because I was in a firefight where nearly the whole platoon was killed, and I collected up the pieces of my buddy Puppy's body and stayed with them until the chopper came, and then I was reassigned to a special mission in Cambodia where we successfully seized 20 tons of supplies headed to VC forces. That was dangerous and exhausting. We worked mostly at night and went into hiding during the day, and it was never clear which Cambodians we could trust and which were communist sympathizers, and there was no reliable source of drinking water, so some of the guys gave in to the temptation of drinking straight from the Mekong without even trying to purify it, and some of those guys got dysentery, and some died. Then I was plucked out of that platoon for a recon mission with 5 other soldiers, one of whom was a guy named Banjo from Cape Girardeau, Missouri, who was at the end of his tour. Basically, as soon as we completed this mission, he could go home to his wife and his 3-year-old daughter and a baby boy he'd never even met. Banjo wasn't wrapped too tight, we all knew it, but he had more time than the rest of us put together, so I was hoping experience would make up for what was clearly a soft spot in his brain. We hiked across the border back into Vietnam, 30 hours over 2 days, and finally encountered Charlie along the trail, but they didn't detect us, so orders were to let them pass and ambush them from behind. But Banjo just lost it and started firing his M16, and then we ended up in a full-blown firefight. We all retreated, but we were in the jungle and we got disoriented, and when Banjo got shot, he dropped our radio. Another guy, Romeo, stepped on a booby trap and got a bamboo spike straight through his foot, so he couldn't go any farther, plus he was howling. I went out in search of the radio because without it, we were lost, and I found it. This big strapping kid named Fitz threw Romeo over his shoulder, and I took Banjo, and we macheted our way out of the jungle to a clearing. The clearing was actually a village that had been bombed out. The whole place was razed, black and charred, parts of it still on fire. And I shot my M16 in the air to see if anyone would materialize. That was when I heard crying. I hunted around until I found a little boy, 5 or 6 years old, sitting next to a woman, obviously the child's mother, who had been killed. I picked him up and we radioed for the chopper and the little kid came with us. I tried to figure out what his name was. The only thing he would say was, "Luck, Luck." So I said, "All right, your name is Luck. And I'll tell you what, little buddy, the name fits." A few days later, I was called up to see one of the big guns, Colonel J.B. Newman, and I had a private audience with him. I thought maybe I was in trouble. I hadn't done anything wrong that I knew of, but even so, I was pretty nervous. I sat down across the desk from Colonel Newman, and he said, "Well, Private Foley, looks like you have a guardian angel." "Sir?" He then proceeded to tell me that someone from even higher up, stratospherically high up, had called to check on me. The colonel had then done some digging and learned about my heroic efforts in the field, staying with the bodies of my buddies Puppy and Frog, going back for the radio and helping Banjo, and rescuing the Viet Cong child from the village. Because what I forgot to tell you was that Luck's mother was wearing the black pajamas of the enemy. The colonel said to me, "Another soldier might have figured the easiest thing was to shoot him." I said, "He was a little kid, sir. Too young to understand why his country was at war." He climbed right into my arms and clung tight to my neck. I wasn't going to let anything happen to him. The colonel said, "You're a good soldier, Foley, and a patriot besides. We need more men like you. I'm putting you in for a promotion and a full week of R&R. You deserve it. Dismissed." I stood up and saluted and said, "Yes, sir. Thank you, sir." It wasn't until I got back outside that I wondered who had been checking in on me. "I figured you used a connection, or Nani did. And I'm not going to keep this from you, Ma. In our conversation, the colonel offered me a cushier position, a job in requisitions, which would basically mean sitting at a warehouse all day keeping track of supplies. I turned the position down, Ma, and here's why. I like being a soldier. I'm good at it. I've seen fellow soldiers, hell, my brothers, blown to bits, and I need to honor their memories by staying on the front lines and finishing what we started together. I can't just hide out in requisitions because my family is privileged and I have connections. When I get home from Guam, I'm going to be assigned to a new platoon as a sergeant. I'm going to be a leader, Ma. I want to say one more thing, and I want you to hear me loud and clear, not like I'm shouting at you from another room or from the end of the driveway like I always used to, but like I'm standing in front of you, Ma, holding your hands, my eyes locked on yours. I plan on coming safely home to you. But the most important thing isn't whether I live or die, Ma. The most important thing is that you go to bed each night believing that you raised a hero. Love, your son, Tiger." Part 3, November 1969. Someday we'll be together. It's a weekend of firsts. McGee has never been to Nantucket Island before, nor has she ever been away from her family on Thanksgiving. When Mrs. Levin called and invited her, saying, "Now that you and Tiger are engaged, you must come meet the family," McGee thought her mother would object. However, her mother had practically packed her bag and pushed her out the door. "It's the natural way of things," Jean Johnson had said. "You're 20 years old. It's time to start your own life." McGee knows her parents have her triplet 8-year-old brothers to feed and clothe. And besides, her mother likes Tiger. She was over the moon when McGee showed her the letter where Tiger proposed. McGee wrote back and accepted, and they'd set a date. Saturday, July 4th, 1970. Tiger will be home at the end of May, just in time to be fitted for his tuxedo. McGee and the Levin, Foley, and Whalen clans arrive on Nantucket by ferry on Wednesday afternoon. McGee worried she might get seasick. She was born and raised in the tiny hamlet of Carlisle, Massachusetts, and her experience on the water has been limited to a rowboat on Walden Pond. But the ferry is huge, like a floating building, big enough to transport 40 cars. They drive off the boat caravan style. McGee is in a station wagon with Tiger's parents and his sisters, Jesse and Kirby. Tiger's other sister, Blair, her husband, and their 4-month-old twins follow in a black Ford Galaxy. In the car, Tiger's mother, Kate, announces that she has a surprise. Kirby and Jesse groan in stereo. Kirby is as pretty as a model. She's stick-thin with golden hair like Tiger's and delicate features, while Jesse is as dark and mysterious as a gypsy child. McGee has always wanted a sister. She desperately wants all three of Tiger's sisters to accept her, so she has been watching their every move.
What kind of surprise? Kirby asks. Kate's face breaks into a grin. McGee has found Kate to be fairly reserved and proper, so her enthusiasm now is something brand new. A big, big surprise. David, don't turn here. Kate's husband, David, has been very kind and welcoming to McGee. Before they left Boston, he pulled McGee aside and said, Don't let this family intimidate you. There are a lot of strong women. Just be yourself. Now, he says to Kate, What do you have up your sleeve, Katie Nichols? I've done something wonderful, Kate says, clapping her hands like a child. Just keep driving where I tell you. McGee will be relieved if they're going to a hotel instead of the grandmother's house. In his most recent letter, Tiger told McGee that she would be expected to shower outside all weekend. That last bit had thrown McGee into a sheer panic. It was 38 degrees outside. They'd been having frost for weeks. Surely Tiger was joking. The two-car caravan rumbles up the cobblestoned main street, lined with charming storefronts. McGee gazes at the pumpkins in windows, the corn shocks by doorways, the last of the orange and red leaves clinging to the trees that line the sides of the road. Does Blair know where we're going? Jesse asks. She does not, Kate says. Kate cranks down her window and waves her arm at the car behind. Blair says to Angus, What is my mother doing? Where are we going?
It looks like she wants us to follow them, Angus says. Maybe to look at the ocean? Is that some kind of Thanksgiving tradition you all have?
No, Blair says. They usually celebrate Thanksgiving at Exalta's house in Beacon Hill as they did last year, when Blair ate the cherrystone clam that didn't agree with her, and then the next day discovered she was pregnant. They did come to Nantucket for Thanksgiving one year when Blair was a teenager. It had been rainy and cold, and Kate lit the fireplace in the living room without remembering to open the flue, and the living room filled with smoke, and Exalta got in a dither about soot ruining the mural. Then it turned out that Nani had forgotten to pick up the turkey they'd ordered from Savinor's before they left, and they ended up eating Thanksgiving dinner at the Woodbox. And to protest the turn the holiday had taken, Blair ordered the beef Wellington. Blair hadn't wanted to come back to Nantucket this year. There just wasn't room for everyone, and especially not since Kate invited McGee. But Kate insisted they would all just cram in. I don't know where they're going, but I don't feel like a wild goose chase right now, Blair says. The second the babies wake up, they'll have to nurse.
They just fell asleep, Angus says. We have at least an hour, maybe longer. I'm going to follow them. Why not?
He reaches out to stroke Blair's leg.
It'll be an adventure.
Blair takes Angus's hand and relaxes against the seat. Angus is a new man, carefree and spontaneous. He received a whopping bonus from NASA, $10,000, but he has declined their offer to work on the next mission. He's going to teach a normal course load, mentor his graduate students, and help out with the babies. Blair had wondered if Angus's psychoanalysis with Trixie was any different than witchcraft, but she has to admit, he really does seem better. He hasn't suffered any episodes, and his general demeanor is looser and more relaxed. He smiles and laughs. He's present and engaged. Blair had called the graduate school admissions office at Harvard to check on the status of her deferral, and was informed that she could start her studies in January. After they get home from Nantucket, Blair will begin to wean the babies, and they will interview nannies. Kate's parents head out on the Matticat Road. If they wanted to see the water, why not drive to Cisco? It's much closer. Where are we going? Blair asks. Kirby can't believe a surprise has been thrown into their Thanksgiving. The whole point of Thanksgiving is tradition, sameness, although this past year has been one of enormous, unpredictable change, so why should Thanksgiving be any different? Kirby wonders if her grandmother is in on this surprise. Exalta came up to the island on Monday, which was completely unheard of, and it made Kirby wonder if there was some truth to Jessie's claim that she had personally witnessed Exalta and Mr. Crimmins kissing, as in really kissing, on the night of the moonwalk. Kirby isn't sure that means Exalta and Mr. Crimmins are sleeping together, perish the thought. But she will concede that Exalta has softened up. Kirby has spent a fair amount of time this fall currying favor with Exalta. She goes to lunch at the Union Club with her once a week because Exalta has agreed to pony up the $3,000 Kirby needs for a semester abroad in Geneva. At their most recent lunch, Exalta ordered a bottle of champagne, and they both got a little tipsy. Exalta had leaned across the table and said, "Tell me, Catherine, about your romantic life. Surely there must be a young man." Kirby felt heat rise to her cheeks, which was a novel sensation. She wasn't sure if it was embarrassment or nerves or love. She had been seeing Darren. There was a date at Mr. Bartley's Burgers. Then after that, an afternoon trip to the aquarium. Then they met at the Boston Public Library to study together and went to Chinatown for noodles afterward. Kirby tried to keep things casual because she was leaving for Switzerland right after the new year and she couldn't risk a heavy romantic entanglement. But then Darren announced that he would be studying that same semester at the university in Genoa, Italy, which was only 2 hours away by train, and so suddenly Kirby was fantasizing about the kind of torrid affair they could conduct in cities where nobody knew them on a continent where no one would judge them. Kirby said, "There's no one special."
"No one?" Exalta asked.
"Well," Kirby said.
Exalta's gaze was unrelenting, and Kirby could see she really did want to know about Kirby's life.
Kirby flashed forward 50 years to 2019, when Kirby herself might have grandchildren. Wouldn't she want to know the truth about their lives? What would being a 21-year-old in 2019 look like? Kirby couldn't begin to imagine.
"There is someone I've been seeing now and again."
"I knew it," Exalta said. "You have that glow. Tell me all about him."
"Well, he goes to Harvard."
"Excellent," Exalta said. "A Harvard man like your grandfather."
Nothing like Gramps, Kirby thought.
"His mother is a doctor and his father is a judge," Kirby said. "He has a house on Martha's Vineyard. That's where I met him."
"This all sounds marvelous," Exalta said. "Why have you been keeping this boy a secret? He sounds divine. Tell me, is he handsome?"
"Very," Kirby said.
"Of course he's handsome," Exalta said. She poured more champagne into both of their glasses.
Kirby watched the bubbles fizz, pop, and evaporate, which was exactly what would happen to Exalta's enthusiasm about Kirby's mystery man.
"Why don't you invite him for Thanksgiving?"
"He has a family," Kirby said. "His parents and aunts, uncles, cousins." She took a sip of her champagne. They would need another bottle if Kirby told the whole truth about Darren.
But why not just come right out and say it? Kirby wondered.
She thought of Senator Kennedy, who had gone on television on July 25th and made a speech of explanation and apology about the Chappaquiddick incident. The Commonwealth of Massachusetts had not spontaneously combusted, nor had its citizens called for Kennedy's head, thrown him in jail, or stripped him of his Senate seat. If the country could accept Kennedy's story of being confused, discombobulated, and in a state of shock following the accident, so much so that he didn't even call the police, then Exalta could accept Kirby's relationship with Darren Fraser. Or at least, she hoped so.
"Darren's black," Kirby said.
She laid her hands on either side of her silverware on top of the linen tablecloth and forced herself to deliver the words right to Exalta's face.
"He's Negro."
Exalta blinked and then said,
"I've learned a lot in my 75 years, Catherine."
She'd lowered her voice into what Kirby thought of as her serious register.
"Some knowledge has come to me quite recently. I'm sure it was difficult for you to tell me that, maybe because you expect me to react in a certain way. But I'll have you know, your young man, what is his name?"
"Darren," Kirby said, "Darren Fraser." You can feel free to bring Darren Fraser to meet me at any time. I would be honored. Inexplicably, this caused Kirby to tear up. Really? Of course, Exalta said. People are people. People are people. Her grandmother couldn't have said anything to make Kirby happier. Now, Kirby turns her attention back to her mother. So, did Nani drive up here by herself on Monday? This seems unlikely. Exalta has a license and a car, but she has never, to Kirby's knowledge, driven all the way to Nantucket. No, Kate says. Bill Crimmins came and fetched her. Jessie pinches Kirby's leg. I told you so, she whispers. Her grandmother and Mr. Crimmins. The society matron and the caretaker. People are people, Kirby thinks. They are headed out to the end of the earth, Jessie thinks. When they are nearly at Mattaket Beach, the best place to see the sunset, Kate tells David to turn left. They go down a winding sand and gravel road that's bordered on both sides by scrub pine and Spanish olives. They cross a battered one-lane wooden bridge, and then the land opens up. There are fields on either side of the road and a steel gray stripe on the horizon, the Atlantic Ocean. Jessie is awestruck. This part of the island is natural and wild. It's a far cry from the manicured streetscapes of town. She tries to memorize every detail so she can write about it to Tiger and to her new pen pal, Pic. Jessie received a letter from Pic in early September, right after school started. He's living in a sustainable community outside of Pottstown, Pennsylvania. His mother did end up taking him to Woodstock, and the way he described it in his letter made Jessie glad she hadn't gone. Pic and Lorraine drove to the concert in a VW bus with a couple from their community. The bus got a flat tire right before Eldred, New York, and Pic said it was easier to abandon the bus and hitch a ride than to track down another tire. The bus didn't have a spare. Pic and Lorraine had to hitch rides in separate cars. The road was a log jam of vehicles headed to the Yasgur farm, and some cars were so crowded that people sat on the roofs and hoods. Pic worried he would never find his mother again. Needle in a haystack, he wrote to Jessie. 400,000 people, half of them women, and all of them looked and acted just like Lavender. Pic hooked up with a couple who had brought their 7-year-old son, Denny, and in exchange for Pic keeping an eye on the little guy, they included Pic in their family unit and shared the food they'd brought. The concert had good moments. Pick's favorite band, Creedence, had played after midnight on Saturday night, but he fell fast asleep before Janis Joplin went on. He woke back up to hear Jefferson Airplane. I'd forgotten where I was, he wrote. Then I heard Grace Slick's voice. There were times when I was bored and tired and hungry, but there were other times when I was part of this teeming, gyrating, smoking, singing mass of humanity. I felt proud to live in this country. When Monday morning rolled around and Jimi Hendrix, the final performer, played a psychedelic version of the Star-Spangled Banner, Pic still hadn't located his mother. He figured she would have wanted to stay and see Hendrix, but he decided if he didn't find her, he would hitch a ride with someone heading back to Cape Cod and return to his grandfather on Nantucket. But then this amazing thing happened. Denny saw a kid who had a balloon animal, and he declared that he wanted one. Pic somehow, through asking one person and then another, found the man who was making the balloon animals. He was clearly strung out. He wore only a pair of red satin shorts and a red bow tie, and Pic was hesitant to approach him. It was Denny who charged forward toward the balloon man, and thank goodness, because Pic saw that the woman who was collecting the money for him, the animals were a dime apiece, was Lavender. We got back to the community in time for me to start at a regular high school, Pic wrote. They had to put me back a grade, but nobody here knows me, so it's not too bad. I miss you, Jessie. Write back. Your friend, Pic. Jessie won't lie. She loved receiving the letter from Pic and she hurried to respond. She considered telling Pick that they were, in a way, related. They were both half-siblings to Blair, Kirby, and Tiger. But that was a family secret, and Jessie felt a certain power in guarding it. If she were to release that secret into the world, who knew what kinds of awful dramas would unfold? So, instead, Jessie wrote to Pick about the two astonishing things that had happened since she'd started seventh grade. The first was that she had been invited to Miss Flower's wedding to Mr. Barstow. The invitation was printed on fine stock, ivory with black lettering, in a script so fancy it was difficult to read. The envelope was addressed to Miss Jessica Levin, and it had impressed even Jessie's parents. Kate had scrutinized the invitation as though it contained a secret message from the Russians. Do you suppose she invited every student in the school? That would only be fair, and yet, one would think, impossible. Jessie did some quiet trawling to see if this was the case. She asked Doris, "What are you doing on Saturday the 20th? Doris had scowled. Over the summer, she had developed a bad case of acne, probably from eating so many McDonald's French fries. "I don't know," she said. "Sleeping in?" Jessie decided she would attend the service at the Church of the Advent in Beacon Hill, but not the reception at the Hampshire House. That way, Kate could drop Jessie off, have a quick visit with Nonny on Mount Vernon Street, then come back and pick Jessie up. Jessie was seated in the middle of the church on the bride's side among a sea of unfamiliar faces. Not only was she the only kid from school there, she was the only child, period, aside from one baby who cried until the organ music started, and everyone stood up as Miss Flowers walked down the aisle. Miss Flowers as a bride was the most beautiful woman Jessie had ever seen in real life. She had her dark hair swept back in a sleek chignon, and she wore a satin column dress and a long sheer silk veil. The most extraordinary thing was that when she passed by Jessie's row, she reached out to Jessie and gave her a soulful smile. Her eyes brimmed with tears as she squeezed Jessie's hand. "Dear Pick, this past Saturday, I was invited to the wedding of my school guidance counselor and the boys' gym teacher. Miss Flowers looked elegant in her white dress and veil. She was crying a little as she walked down the aisle. At first, I thought she was sad because Miss Flowers was meant to be married last year to a man named Rex Rothman, who was killed during the Tet Offensive. But then I realized her tears were tears of hope and of gratitude because she had been given a second chance at love with Mr. Barstow. The second astonishing thing that happened was that Jessie found a new boyfriend, Andy Perlstein. He was in Jessie's English class. During roll call, their teacher, Miss Malintantis, had mispronounced Jessie's last name as Levin, rhyming it with the pin, and Jessie had surprised herself by speaking up and saying, "It's Levin, rhymes with heaven." "Levin rhymes with heaven," Miss Malintantis said. "Thank you, I love that." Andy, who sat three seats up and one row to the left, turned around and winked at Jessie. Later that week, when they were discussing their summer reading, Anne Frank, The Diary of a Young Girl, Andy had raised his hand and said, "I think it stinks that she dies in the end. The book would have been way better if she had lived." Shane Harris then argued that the point of the book was that Anne had died. If she had lived, Shane said, no one would care about this diary. "You're only saying that because you're not Jewish," Andy said. Jessie's hand flew to her Tree of Life necklace, and Miss Malintantis jumped in to redirect the discussion. After class, Jessie sought out Andy. He was a few inches taller than her. He must have been one of the boys who sprouted up over the summer. Jessie looked up at him and said, "I agree with you. I think it stinks that Anne died. I actually cried."
"You did?" Andy said.
He seemed on the verge of confessing that he had shed a tear too, but there wasn't a seventh grade boy in the world who would admit to that. That weekend, Pammy Pope called to see if Jessie wanted to play tennis at the Chestnut Hill Reservoir. Pammy Pope had overheard Jesse telling Doris about Miss Flower's wedding in the girls' locker room, and this gave Jesse a social boost she hadn't predicted. Jesse put on her whites and her visor and stuck her autographed Jack Kramer racket in her basket and biked to the park to meet Pammy. She saw Andy and a couple of other boys from school kicking a soccer ball. He jogged right over to Jesse and asked what she was doing, and she said, "I'm playing tennis with Pammy Pope." It wasn't as glamorous as saying she was a fourth in a mixed doubles match at a house party on Hilton Head, but it had had the same effect on Andy. He looked impressed and said, "I'll wait for you, and when you're done, let's bike to Brigham's for ice cream." He was asking her on a date. Jesse shrugged. "Okay." Pammy showed up, and they agreed to play one set, and Jesse won 6-2. Pammy invited Jesse to sleep over. She said she had just gotten the new Beatles album, Abbey Road, if Jesse wanted to listen to it, and Jesse said, "Let's do it next weekend. I have plans tonight." This was the exact right response, because Pammy said, "Okay, let's definitely do it next weekend." She biked off, and Andy loped over, soccer ball under his arm, his dark bangs sweaty at the hairline, which made him look kind of cute. "Who won?" Andy asked. Jesse zipped up her racket case. "We weren't really keeping score. Pammy is a good player."
"Really?" Andy said, "because it looked like you were creaming her."
"Oh," Jesse said, "were you watching?"
"Like Miss Flowers, I've gotten my own second chance at love."
Jesse crosses this out. She doesn't want Pick to know he was her first chance at love. He'll become conceited.
"I have a new boyfriend. His name is Andy. He plays soccer and likes the Beatles. He took me to see Goodbye, Mr. Chips, and next weekend his parents are taking us to the Boston College football game against the Naval Academy, and we're having a tailgate picnic. I miss you too. Write soon. Your friend, Jesse."
David slows down when the road curves to the left, and Jesse sees a dilapidated barn with its roof caving in.
"This is Red Barn Road," Kate says, "and that's the barn."
"Is this the surprise?" Jesse wonders, because if so, it stinks.
"Do I keep going?"
David asks. He sounds wary. "What are they doing out here?"
"Up ahead," Kate says, "pull into that driveway."
David turns to her.
"Katie Nichols, what have you done?"
"Welcome home," Kate says.
There's one other house up ahead. It's huge, bigger than All's Fair and Little Fair put together, bigger than their house in Brookline, bigger than Exalta's house on Mount Vernon Street.
"Holy moly," Kirby yells. "Did you buy this? Is this ours?"
"We did,"
Kate says. "It's ours."
Kirby pushes Jesse out the door.
"Go, go!"
Jesse climbs out and stands in front of the house, taking it in. She starts another letter in her head, this time to Tiger.
"We have a new house on Nantucket. Wait until you see it."
"Holy moly," Kirby cries out. "Did you buy this? Is this ours?"
"We did," Kate says. "It's ours."
Blair and Angus pull up behind them in the Galaxy. Blair gets out of the car and closes the door gently so as not to wake the babies.
"What is this?"
"This," Kate says, "is our new house."
"What?" Blair says. "Our new house?"
David looks at Kate the exact same way he looked at her the first time he saw her, when Kate, newly a widow, had opened the door to welcome in the lawyer who was going to defend her late husband's life insurance claim. David had later confessed that his knees buckled at the sight of her.
"I didn't know God made women as beautiful as you."
"Katie," he says.
"I bought it," she says.
It's intoxicating to know that she has done the right thing, not only for herself, but for David, for the children, for her grandchildren.
Jesse says, "Can I pick out my room?"
"Go ahead," Kate says.
Her heart is filling her chest. It's hard to breathe.
Wait, David says. He leads Kate up the walk by the hand, and then he scoops her up in his arms and carries her across the threshold like they're newlyweds. It feels like a fresh start. How many do you get in one life? Kate wonders. David kisses her cheek. Thank you, he whispers. The dynamics of Tiger's family are a lot to learn, but by the time Thanksgiving dinner rolls around, McGee has them figured out, she thinks. Kate prepares the turkey and assigns Kirby, Jesse, and McGee to tasks in the kitchen, but everyone is on an equal footing because no one knows which cabinet holds the plates or whether or not they have a potato masher or which drawer holds the silverware. Kate bought the house furnished, but they're going to replace what's here with new things, hopefully by summer. When they all first arrived here, Kate led McGee upstairs and informed her that the bright, spacious room with two windows overlooking the water would be hers and Tiger's. Think about what color you'd like to paint it, Kate said. McGee felt like a newly crowned princess. She lay down across the big white bed and imagined sleeping there with Tiger, maybe even conceiving a child there. Both Tiger and McGee want a passel of kids, 4 or 5. The dinner menu for Thanksgiving. Turkey with dressing made from day-old Portuguese bread, which Kate bought from a bakery downtown. Mashed potatoes. Kate adds sour cream and tops them with snipped green onions. McGee must remember to tell her mother about this. Her mother's cooking needs some updating. Scalloped corn. Carrots boiled in orange juice and topped with brown butter and cinnamon. Brussels sprouts roasted in the oven. Cranberry sauce out of a can, just like at McGee's house. The pies, pumpkin and apple, Kate bought at the bakery as well. They will be topped with Brigham's ice cream, vanilla and butter brickle, Tiger's favorite. Kate brought linens from home, along with silver candlesticks and ivory tapers. Jesse makes a centerpiece out of gourds and apples. Kate turns the transistor radio to WBUR, which broadcasts classical music. All of this is a far cry from Thanksgiving at McGee's house. Jean Johnson makes sweet potatoes topped with marshmallows and green bean casserole with crispy onions and turkey with store-bought stuffing. And because no one likes pie, she serves a Sara Lee chocolate cake. McGee's brothers always complain about the beans. They skim the marshmallows off the top of the sweet potatoes. The Johnsons eat at the kitchen table just like every other meal, and McGee's father, Al Johnson, drinks his usual Budweiser from a can. McGee wouldn't say she dreads Thanksgiving, but neither does it feel like a holiday the way it does here. With three little boys in her house, McGee's family Christmas is far more festive. Kate asks McGee to set the table for 10, and McGee worries that she will make a mistake. In her studies to become a dental hygienist, she has proved to be good at memorizing incisors, cuspids, molars, and now she wishes she'd taken a book about table settings out of the library. Wine goblet, water goblet, fork, knife, spoon, dessert fork, all of those McGee can handle. She actually isn't sure which goblet is which, so she quietly asks Kirby, who says, "Water goblet is bigger. It goes here." She places it to the side of the wine goblet. It's pathetic that I know that, but Nani is a Brahmin. McGee is glad there aren't fish forks or soup spoons or cordial glasses. There is a moment of confusion, however, because McGee counts only 9 people who are eating, and yet Kate clearly told her to set the table for 10. Is there a guest McGee doesn't know about? A family member she's forgotten? She asks Kate, who says, "We're setting an honorary place for Tiger, so the chair next to yours will be empty. And look, I got this." She shows McGee a small American flag on a stand, the same kind that rested on teachers' desks when McGee was in grade school. "Tiger's seat will be on the left side, second from the head." McGee has a lump in her throat as she sets the flag at the place Kate specified. At 5 o'clock, Exalta Nichols, Nani, as she's known, Tiger's grandmother, arrives with a man whom Kate calls Bill.
McGee isn't sure who Bill is. She knows Tiger's grandfather has passed, and Tiger said that Exalta doesn't have a new husband or a boyfriend unless you count Rod Laver. But it's quite clear that Exalta and Bill are a couple. He holds her arm as they enter, and he helps her off with her coat, and he offers to fetch her cocktail. McGee herself enjoyed a glass of champagne in the kitchen as she helped get everything ready. Kate had popped the cork off a bottle and poured glasses for McGee and Kirby and Blair. "We drank champagne as we prepared dinner," McGee imagines telling her mother. The champagne has also eased McGee's nerves about meeting Exalta. Once Exalta has been relieved of her coat and handed her cocktail, a gin and tonic served in a highball glass with an artful twist of lime, McGee is ushered forward to be presented to her. "My nanny," Tiger had said before he left, "can be intimidating." But the woman McGee meets is tiny in stature, with a silver bobbed haircut held back from her face by a black velvet headband. She wears a soft red turtleneck sweater and pearl earrings. Her eyes widen as she takes stock of McGee. "Aren't you lovely?" Exalta says, reaching for McGee's hand. "And you're wearing Penn's class ring. How divine that it fits." It doesn't fit. McGee has wound tape around the back, but she won't show Exalta that. "It's a pleasure to meet you," she says. Exalta turns to Bill. "Isn't she just beautiful?" What interests McGee at that point isn't Bill's response. He benignly agrees, although really, what else could he do? But the glowing expression on Exalta's face as she looks at Bill. McGee recognizes that she and Exalta are members of the same tribe. They are women in love. They all sit down to eat. The turkey is golden brown, fragrant, and steaming in the center of the table, just like in a Norman Rockwell painting. David is at the head of the table, with Exalta at the other end. McGee is in the middle between Kirby and the empty chair, and on the other side of the empty chair is Jesse. This is McGee's spot. She is becoming part of this story. Pennington Nichols met Exalta at a debutante ball in 1917, just after he returned from fighting in World War I. 52 years later, McGee Johnson went for driving lessons because her mother decided it was worth the $30 fee to have McGee help her drive the boys around. McGee stepped out of the Walden Pond Driving Academy office, and there, leaning against the car at the curb, was her instructor. He'd stuck out his hand with a devilish grin. Devilish, he informed her later, because after 12 weeks of working as an instructor at this school, he had finally been assigned a pretty girl his age. "Good morning," he said. "I'm Tiger." She had noticed his eye right away, feline, wild, mesmerizing. David rises to offer words of thanks and then lifts his glass. McGee raises her glass, filled with a delicious red wine. The only thing that could make this moment more perfect, she thinks, would be for Tiger to walk in right now, dressed in his combat fatigues, his expression weary but grateful. However, things like that happen only in the movies and in novels. But incredibly, just as all the adult members of the Levin, Foley, and Whalen clans raise their glasses and say, "Cheers!" and as baby Genevieve utters a happy cry from her wind-up swing, the front door of the house opens. They all turn. McGee's heart hovers. It's a hummingbird, wings beating so fast they can't be seen. Kate jumps to her feet. "Tiger." But there's no one standing at the door. It's just the wind blowing in off the water. Fortunate Son, reprise. Sergeant Richard Tiger Foley is 8,700 miles away from Nantucket at Landing Zone George, southeast of Pleiku, in the central highlands of Vietnam. To surprise the troops, the U.S. Army has flown in turkeys, mashed potatoes, and Marmite cans filled with gravy. It's not perfect,
There were no candied yams, no acorn squash or pickled okra, no soft snowflake rolls, no ziti for the soldiers who grew up with Italian grandmothers, and they're all served cranberry juice instead of cranberry sauce. But it still feels festive. Major Freeland, aptly named, stands to say grace, and the men all bow their heads. Lord, we offer thanks for the meal we are about to receive. We pray that you will keep us safe on the battlefield, and that you will instill in us courage, strength, forbearance, resolve, patience, and trust in our fellow soldiers, so that we may continue our efforts to bring peace to this war-torn country. He pauses long enough that Tiger looks up. The major, he can see, is struggling. We ask you to hold in the palm of your hand the brave men we have lost. Puppy, Tiger thinks. Frog. So many others. What must their families' Thanksgivings be like today? Then he thinks of Luck, the little Vietnamese boy he carried out of the smoldering village. The life he saved.
And let them know we miss them. And we'll carry on in their honor and on behalf of all the good citizens of the United States of America. In your name we pray. Amen.
McGee, Tiger thinks. Blair, Kirby, Messi, David, Exalta, Angus, the twins Tiger has yet to meet. And his mother. His mother, Kate, loves him more than all those other people put together. Because, well, because she's his mother. Some folks are born, made to wave the flag. And he is one. Other soldiers at this table may be wishing they were safe in their homes with their families. But Tiger knows that, right now, he's where he's supposed to be. And he will see his family again soon enough. Of this, he is certain.
Amen. He says.
Author's note. I'm frequently asked where I get the ideas from my books. Much of the time, I don't have a satisfying answer for this beyond ideas come to me in the night. But the novel you've just listened to had a very specific genesis. My twin brother, Eric Hildebrand, and I were born at Boston Hospital for Women on July 17, 1969. The week we were born was one of the most eventful weeks of the 20th century. The Apollo 11 mission launched the day before my brother and I launched. It was always my intention to include my own birth in this book, but in the end, I decided I wanted the twins born on the day of the moon launch. So the Whalen twins, Genevieve and George, are one day older than Eric and me. The weekend after we were born was the weekend of the Chappaquiddick incident, which was of enormous interest to the nation, but even more so to residents of Massachusetts. The atmosphere of the country in the summer of 1969 was tumultuous. Nixon was a new president. The war in Vietnam was raging right along with protests against that war. Civil rights and women's lib were hot topics, and Woodstock was planned as a tribute to the nation's youth, who wanted peace, love, and rock and roll. Within my own family that summer, there was also uncertainty, unrest, and excitement. My mother didn't find out she was having twins until she was 7 months along. She was, like Blair, just so big, with only one dress that fit. My father was gravely ill and had to undergo surgery at Mass General in mid-July, which was serious, but everyone believed he would be home and on the mend by the time the twins made their appearance. He did make it through surgery just fine, but not in time for our birth. My mother went into labor at 3 a.m. on July 17th, 4 weeks before her due date, and, as family legend goes, my grandmother, then 49, and today a robust 99, ran every red light in downtown Boston to get my mother to the hospital. My mother's obstetrician was hungover, too much celebrating the moon launch, and because twin births were so rare, he was asked if a class of 40 student nurses could watch the delivery. My mother was in twilight sleep and not really in a position to protest.
I was born first at 10:04 a.m., and all of the student nurses bet that the second would also be a girl. When my brother entered the world at 10:10, it was to an enthusiastic round of applause. And you know what? He's a great guy, an exceptionally wonderful father, and, along with my other siblings, my best friend in all the world. He has earned that applause many, many times over. This novel is my birthday present to him. It was Eric's suggestion that I someday write about the year and circumstances of our birth. I did the best I could. I beg my kind reader's indulgence for the places where I changed facts and circumstances, on Nantucket, on the vineyard, and in the country as a whole, in the service of my narrative. In this novel, I strive to bring you not empirical truth, but emotional truth. I like to think Jesse would approve. Ellen Hildebrand, Nantucket, Massachusetts, December 12th, 2018. This has been a Hachette Audio production of Summer of 69, written by Ellen Hildebrand, read by Aaron Bennett, produced by Dennis Kao, directed by John Kovarik, sound edited by Fred Koch and Mike Sandoval, mixing and mastering by Ian Lehman, production supervised by Christine M. Farrell. Summer of 69 is also available in print and digital formats from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2019 by Ellen Hildebrand. Audio production copyright 2019 Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions at hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales, is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.